Good afternoon. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to Vox Pop for this Thursday, July 10th. I'm Samantha Simmons. It's gardening today, and we welcome Greg Ward from Ward's Nursery, Fred Breglia of Landis Arboretum, and Dale Isla Riggs of the Berry Patch. So give us a call at 1-800-348-2551. That's 1-800-348-2551. This is always a popular program, so make sure to get your calls in early. You can also email us your questions at voxpop@wamc.org. But that number again is 1-800-348-2551. Fred, Dale Isla, and Greg, and your gardening calls all coming up on Vox Pop after this news. Hello once again and welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Samantha Simmons. The gardeners are back and ready to take your calls. You guys were just here a couple weeks ago with me. Fred Breglia is director of the Landis Arboretum in Esperance, New York. Greg Ward runs Ward's Nursery, a gardening destination in Great Barrington, Massachusetts. And Dale Isla Riggs is the owner and operator of the Berry Patch, a first-generation diversified farm in Steventown, New York. We welcome your gardening calls at 1-800-348-2551. That's 1-800-348-2551. And you can email us at voxpop@wamc.org. Fred, Greg, and Dale Isla, welcome back to Vox Pop.
It's great to be back. Yeah. Thanks
great
for having us.
Great to be here in an air-conditioned place on a humid day.
I bet. Man. All right. We got a ton of emails lining up, so I think we're just going to hop right into that.
Sounds good.
Matt says, can your guests tell me what they know about the deer tongue plant, which seems to be taking over a large part of my backyard? Is it invasive? Do I need to be concerned about it or just leave it alone?
Deer tongue is what he's calling it, huh?
Yeah.
The only thing I know called deer tongue is there's a fern called deer tongue. I'd like to know a little more about the name, so maybe somebody can we'll check on that in a minute and be able to figure it out. And I think that's all we have to say until we know more, right?
Did we talk about recently that ferns, like, they kind of grow a bit wild?
Ferns are really great ground covers. There's like several native ones that do a great job. There's a few that are non-native, that are non-invasive, that also do a great job. That looks like an orchid of some kind.
You got the same
is there a
thing,
name on there? Is there a genus on there?
Species of grass.
Well, that would be easy to get rid of. Just mow it.
Yep, common name of deer tongue, species of grass.
Huh. Okay. And does it have a genus on there?
Dicanthelium.
Okay, nope, don't know that one. Interesting, that's not an issue that I think any of us have really dealt with, right,
no,
Fred?
No, I also haven't dealt with that one. But, you know, the fact that we haven't makes me think that it's probably not going to be the hardest to control.
Right, and so, you know, gardening is about weeding. And so if it's in the garden mixed in with the plants you like, you would use a little cultivator. I like a little spading fork, either a handheld kind of flat tines fork or a nice short D-handle, small headed, you know, usually stainless steel is really nice to just use as a weeder. Just does a great job of kind of loosening the soil enough so that you can find the roots, especially the ones that are sort of running a bit that you might break off by mistake. And if you do that, it might sprout back again. So just weeding that would be the way to go. And of course, if it's, you know, in the driveway or something, you can use a little vinegar on that. And, you know, it's toxic to use. The vinegars that are used for weed killers are like 30%, and they do off-gas a bit. So you do want to be careful when to protect yourself when you're applying them. But once applied, they just damage the plant and the plant.
They also sell a product called Burnout, which is like citrus oils.
Yeah, and, same thing though. Off-gases a bit.
It is. And, it does off-gas as well.
You want to have some eye protection. Yep. You may even want to wear a paper respirator, a mask of something like a N95 or something, just so you're not inhaling any of that, and then certainly not doing it on a windy day.
And these are organic products, but that doesn't mean that they're not, you know, they could be caustic, they could be dangerous. Organic doesn't mean necessarily safe.
It is a perennial, and it reproduces from rhizomes, so it does have the ability to resprout, so it'll be important to keep after it.
And that's probably why he's having some issues with it, because of the rhizomial spreading.
I really think, you know, weeding with a, you know, a SWO or, you know, some kind of action hoe is great for little short, little seedling weeds. But if you're into some perennial weeds, especially ones that spread by roots, the roots, you know, getting the soil loose a few inches down so that you can gently work the roots out is really the best way to deal with that.
The other thing is that it often grows in acid soils, and it can take high levels of aluminum. So you might want to do a pH test, and it might be that getting some lime in that area may make it less likely, will allow other species to grow better and help smother it out.
That's a good point, too. And a lot of turf likes more alkaline conditions. So if he's going for, if it's in a problem in the grass area, adjusting the pH could make a difference.
Yeah.
There you go.
There we go. Before we started the show here, we were talking about the humidity, and this is kind of my own question baked in here. Does watering your plants have to change when it's like more humid out?
Partially. Yeah. They won't, you know, won't, the soils won't dry out as quick when it's humid. So, you know, your watering requirements may be, you know, a little less often. And then also when you do water with humidity, you want to make sure you keep the foliage really dry.
Yeah.
It's not going to dry out, and it's, you know, it's easy, and it's going to help to spread more fungal problems.
I don't, personally at home, everything, you know, it's been raining pretty regularly up until maybe about 10 days ago, 2 weeks ago, and then it kind of stopped, and we started to get a little dry weather, and we started to get these intermittent thunderstorms that were very narrow. They would hit one place but not another.
Yeah.
And so some people were getting good rains and some people weren't. So this week was the first time I broke out the sprinkler to water my vegetable garden. And I'm glad I did, because then we actually got one of those nice narrow bands, and I got almost an inch of rain twice in a row last night and the night before. So that really hydrated everything, and I'm really happy now with a little bit of some mulching hay or materials. I'm feeling like everything's going to just take off even again. So we are just starting to get into that watering time. I don't know what's happening in the berry patch.
Yeah, we just got our irrigation turned on last weekend. We turned it on one weekend early and the pump didn't work. So then we got it fixed. And last weekend, the blueberries that are now starting to ripen got a nice watering. And we will do it deeply on the weekends, and then we don't water during the week, partly to save on electricity rates.
Hmm. Interesting. Yeah. So we're in the middle of summer. The humidity is there, but if you're not getting any of those thunderstorms, and you have put in some plants this year, you know, vegetable plants, annual plants, or even some perennial and woody plants, you're definitely going to want to be watering. You know, once a week is ideal in a deep watering. If you're putting in brand new plants this week, then you're usually doing that two or three times in a row to start. So do it. You plant them today. You would water really well today. You might go back and do it again tomorrow and the next day. And then you could go to that once a week schedule of, again, deep watering.
Yep. And things are drying out. I mean, at the Arboretum, we've probably gone close to 2 weeks without rain now.
And, oh, yeah. So you're shy then.
It's dry. Yeah. Yep. Actually, the lawns, and we mow our lawns always a little on the high side, and you can start to see things are browning, you know, it's hard to believe that it went
snuck
from,
right up on you.
It really did. It's, you know, it's crazy how it goes that way.
Nick wants to know, can I go grow peach trees from fruit at the store? What's the easiest stone fruit to plant?
So I wouldn't get the ones from the store. I would, but you definitely can grow peach trees in New York State. No problem. They do really well. Red Haven's a really good cultivar. Cold Hardy Flaming Fury is another really good one. Reliance has always been a good one. There's quite a few peaches out there that, you know, definitely going to work. But if you go from the store, you're not going to get the actual cold hardy variety. So
It's unlikely. I mean, you can't. They will germinate, you know, and you can get a tree, and it's just really going to be hit and miss. I have seen them pop up in old sort of compost piles and things like
too.
That. Though, so you could try them if you've already got some started. See what happens.
Certainly worth a shot.
It'll take probably 4 or 5 years before you see a fruit.
Yeah,
you know, if you have lots of space and you're into plant genetics, go for it. But if you have kind of a a small area and want to make sure that you get good quality peaches, should go buy a grafted tree at the nursery.
And he had a follow-up question. He has plants in some spaces of his home that get really good sunlight in the morning. They do better inside than they do outside. Are early morning hours of the sun somehow more potent or beneficial for some plants?
They always seem to be best. I don't know that I understand why, but if you have houseplants, that east window is always the best choice. East and then south, if it's a highlight plant. West is third and north is fourth in line, unless it's a very, very low light plant, which wouldn't mind the north.
That's right.
The number to call is 1-800-348-2551, and you can email us at voxpop@wamc.org. We're going to take a quick break, and we'll be back soon. Welcome back to Vox Pop. The number to call is 1-800-348-2551. We're talking gardening. Let's take a call. We're going to go to Gloria in Schenectady. Hi, Gloria.
Oh, hey. Thank you for taking my call. I've been enjoying this so far, so thank you. To get to the point, we recently moved into our home, and there's this thing called Japanese knotwood. And
knotweed.
It's like taking over. Pardon?
Japanese knotweed.
Okay. Yes. And it's like it's in three areas. It's like my home, my neighbor's, my two neighbors' home, and I want to get rid of it. And we've all talked about getting rid of it, but I don't know how to do that. And we decided we do not want to use pesticides or whatever you call them. Forgive me, I'm like a city slicker who just moved into the suburbs. So I'm learning about gardening.
Yep. So that's a common problem plant that we get a lot of calls on, and it's one that probably all of us have had to battle in some capacity, one form or another. It's an invasive, and it looks kind of like a bamboo. And the fact that you and your neighbors are collectively wanting to go after it is a good thing, because if one of the neighbors leaves some and you get rid of yours, it's most likely coming back. The good thing about this is that it is fairly easy to control in some capacities by just cutting or smothering it with you can either use a black plastic, or you could use like a weed fabric type material, and in the areas that you can kind of smother that that plant, and that would stop a lot of it. And if you can keep mowing it, if it's mowable, it will definitely go away. Any area that you can mow with knotweed, it can't live. So smothering it and cutting regularly should control it.
And so if smothering is the only option, if covering it with some kind of material is the only option, cutting it all down first, of course, would make it much easier to cover.
Yeah, exactly.
And also stress the plants right now, so they would be more likely to fail sooner.
Is there a specific time of year that we should do this?
I'd say any time, now is good. You can just, like Greg said, you have to cut it because it's tall, so you want to cut it down and then ideally smother it. And I like weed fabric, not for landscapes, but for smothering plants, because it lets air and it lets water into the soil, and it helps to keep all the microbial activity of the soil healthier. So black plastic stops all of that. So for that reason, I like weed fabric better, but black plastic in a short-term solution is not going to make much of a difference. So either way, cut it, smother it, and then you should see, and if you and your neighbors are collectively doing this at the same time, you should see some pretty significant levels of control right away. And I would do it right away.
But it could take a year.
Right? It could.
Or more.
Yeah. Yep, it could.
So you're going to do it, and if you uncover it, things may sprout again, even though it looks dormant.
Yep.
So keeping it covered for the rest of this year, and then maybe if you need to, you can uncover it in the spring, see what happens, and recover as needed.
Yep.
And if it's in an area where you're not able to mow, using a weed whacker would work.
Yep.
Just get it cut as close to the ground as you possibly can.
Indeed.
Yeah, it's an area where I cannot cut mow, but I figured I'd go out there and chop it down with a little saw or something.
You could use that too.
They're really thick.
They are. They're thick like a big bamboo.
Yeah, I mean, they're kind of pretty, but then they're, like, taking over, and then my neighbors are just talking, and it's like, no, this is terrible.
Yep, and it is an invasive. It's one that, you know, definitely takes over habitat. Along streams, we see it, like, so thick, it's hard to believe. I used to walk around trout streams, and now it's like a jungle, and it's almost all that knotweed. So it's, you know, definitely one that's not good. The only positive I could say about it is that the bees, pollinators like it, in particular bees, and it does make a decent honey.
Oh, wow. Well, I've actually started to put in a bee garden because I figured, well, they need something place to go to. So.
Okay. Well, good luck with that.
Great.
Thanks, Gloria.
Thank you. Thank you for your advice. Bye-bye.
We'll go to Chris from Housatonic now. Hi, Chris.
Hey there. I have a few questions. My mom planted me three fern trees in the back of my house. Do those trees need water?
So were they planted this year, Chris?
Oh, no, they were planted many, many years ago.
I think they're probably getting enough water on their own then. You're all set on those.
And then the other thing, can you plant limes and lemons in your garden?
Only for the summer. And so you can... You can put them outside for the summer, and if you wanted to put them in the garden and sort of pretend they're planted, drop the whole pot, you know, into the ground for the summer, that could work. But you're going to, in order to keep them indefinitely, you're going to want to pull them up in late September, early October, and bring them inside.
How about avocados?
I think same story. Same story. Yeah.
Yep.
Okay.
All right.
All right. Thanks, Chris.
Thank you very much.
Karen from Kingston wants to know, what's the best deterrent for hornworms on tomatoes? They might be called horn caterpillars. You guys would know better than I do, though.
Yeah, hornworms are the larvae of the sphinx moth. They're a great, big, beautiful moth that flies at night. Once you start to find that you've got hornworm in your tomatoes, you can use a microbial insecticide, Bacillus thuringiensis, also called BT. You can find it at any garden center. The other thing to look for is if you're starting to find the larvae, especially when you get big ones, sometimes you'll see these batches of white cocoons coming out of the top of the hornworm, and that's a native wasp that actually parasitizes the hornworms, which I think is really cool. Sam here is kind of scrunching her nose.
Sort of like that alien.
The alien movie. Yeah. It is kind of like that.
Yeah. So if you find those, leave them, because those are going to die, and the wasps will reproduce in that. They will hatch out of those cocoons and then lay their eggs in other hornworms. And so you'll get some natural control that way. And you might see anywhere from one or two cocoons up to 20 or 30 coming out of a single hornworm. So if you see those white cocoons, just let them be and let nature run its course. And if you're not seeing them, you can either hand pick them off or spray some BT, and that will take care of them.
Yeah. I mean, if you have just a few plants, say even 10, wouldn't take long to go through them. They're the same color as the tomato, so they kind of blend in. It wouldn't take long to go through them and look for these guys, because they're, once you see them, you'll go, oh my gosh, that's a big thing on my tomato plant.
Yep, it's large, so it definitely stands out.
And you will see that something is eating your tomatoes. They might be eating the leaves. The problem is if they decide to be eating on the fruit. So yeah, it kind of depends how much effort you want to put into it.
Are there any bugs that are going to eat your fruit or vegetable, whatever, in your garden, that it would be harmful for you to then consume that?
Not that I'm aware of. Nothing comes to mind.
Not a
pleasant experience.
It's like the apple and the worm.
Right.
You know? You
don't exactly.
You will get a little protein with your roughage and vitamins.
That's right.
You know, any time you have a fruit that looks good except it's damaged somewhere, you can just, you know, cut that out with a paring knife and you'll be all set.
Yeah, and that's what I usually do. We just, you know, cut the part off, because sometimes even if it's an insect, it's not a disease, it'll start to cause some rot. So I just cut that whole area off. Same thing when you forage. You know, mushrooms are really common. It's very hard to find a mushroom in the woods that doesn't have something eating on it, especially if they're edible ones. They, the critters know good poisonous ones and good ones that are good to eat. So just cut the slug damage off and go away.
And, you know, there's usually the biggest culprit is sweet corn. And it's one of the reasons that growers have to spray sweet corn is people say they don't want worms in their sweet corn. There's three different species of worms that will go after sweet corn. But you can just take one of those paring knives and cut off the tip if it's earworm. That'll be at the very tip. If it's corn borer, it might go in through the side. You'll see the hole on the side. But again, just take a paring knife and... you know, if you don't want to be eating things that have been sprayed, it's really, really hard to grow sweet corn. The organic growers wind up spraying a microbial insecticide to keep the worms out, but it's something you can easily solve by just cutting it out.
Yep. The flip side of that is if you do see something eating it, then you know that that product's not sprayed. And, you know, so sometimes seeing a critter or two in there is not a bad thing.
Mm-hmm. Delilah brought in... five-ish, I think. I can't see completely beyond the computer here, pints of blueberries. And I didn't know that there were different types of blueberries, even though I was a blueberry picker. So, and it's U-pick season, so I see the signs everywhere. So,
yes, our pick-your-own start opens this Sunday, as does our farm store. I brought in the five earliest varieties. So we actually have 19 different varieties of blueberries in our blueberry patch. Oh. So we have as long a season as possible. The earliest variety is called Duke that we're picking right now. And the latest variety that we have are some called Bonus and Liberty, which are giant, both varieties. But people are always surprised that there's different varieties of blueberries, different varieties of strawberries. It's really no different than, you know, people are used to different varieties of apples. Yep. And how they all taste different. Well, it's the same thing with the blueberries. So it's always fun to kind of do some taste testing. Some are sweeter, some are more tart. Some are bigger, some are smaller. The Northlands here are a variety that are smaller. And so people often say, oh, I don't want to pick the small ones. But I actually find that those are the best to use in like blueberry muffins because some of these others are so big, you get four berries or five berries in a muffin and you don't really have much muffin left. So, yeah, it's good to get out to a pick your own place and pick your own or come to a farmer's market or farm store and ask what varieties they are. Sometimes ours get mixed together because our crew picks into buckets going down the row and then they get mixed together. But oftentimes we do keep them separate as well.
Can I ask a question?
Yeah, of course.
Oh, Toro. Tell us about that one.
So Toro is a bit of a newer variety. It's one of my favorites. It's got really nice size. It is a little bit lighter blue in color. The problem with Toro is that it's actually a bit more difficult to grow. It doesn't seem to like the Northeast environment as much. But flavor-wise, of the five varieties that I brought today, my favorites are Toro and Blue Ray. I think they have a little bit more sweetness and a little bit more oomph to the flavor.
Yeah, great.
And you guys will have to tell me what you think of the different varieties as well.
The number to call is 1-800-348-2551, or you can email us at voxpop@wamc.org. So with these blueberries, I assume they're all blue. I'm going to be real dense right now. Or do they have, like, do they vary? Like, apples, they all look a little bit different, but do the blueberries, other than, like, their size?
Most of them are, all the ones that we grow are blue, but there are a couple specialty varieties out there. There's one that's pink.
There's a couple of new compact varieties that are, when they're ripe, they're kind of pinkish, pink with a little. And I'm sorry, I can't come up with the names. I'm getting too old, but I will after the break. I promise.
Yeah, the good thing about those ones that are off color is that they often deter. Like birds will actually watch these berries and they'll wait for them to turn blue and then they'll get them. So these pink ones could kind of, or purpley ones could kind of trick them. So sometimes they're ripe before they actually turn blue, and the birds don't know that. So you can kind of beat the birds a little bit easier.
Not my catbirds, let me tell you.
No way. Well, they're smart. They're a little bit more.
They don't care.
They don't care.
It's green. They'll eat it.
I've been seeing even on elderberries. Usually they wait for them to turn ripe, but I've noticed. I think it's a bunch of cedar waxwings that are just they are in the backyard. We have one big shrub, and they are just there. There's. I was waiting to. Oh, I'm going to get some elderberries this year. I don't think I'm going to get any elderberries, Greg. Nope. I think the cedar waxwing has got them all.
Oh, yeah, they will. So one of the keys with blueberries is everybody thinks that as soon as it's blue, it's ripe. But it's actually not ripe as far as sweet ripe for 5 to 7 days after it has turned fully blue.
Oh, wow.
So a lot of people will get blueberries and they're like, ooh, they're tart. And some people think that a blueberry is supposed to be tart. I like my blueberries sweet and fully ripe. And so the way to tell if a blueberry is really ripe or not is if you look at the green stem attaching to the blueberry itself. When it's truly fully ripe, you'll get a blue band at the bottom of that green stem where it's attaching to the fruit. If it's not fully ripe, it will stay green and will probably not be as sweet. But if that blue band is on that green stem, that's as long as it's a sweet variety, that is going to be a fully ripe blueberry. So we spend a lot of time training our crew. First, they look with their eyes, and then they get a feel. Picking blueberries is all about the feel in the fingers and the thumbs. And if they come off easily with your thumb, they're ripe and they're sweet. And if they tug back at all, you should leave them on the plant and leave them for a couple more days so they get fully ripe.
Now, if you happened to not be an expert blueberry picker and you pick a bunch of blueberries that pop off, but maybe they had a little tug give back, you can leave those in at room temperature in your house for a few days and will they get sweeter?
So they can get bluer, but they will not get sweeter. Okay. The sugars do not continue to build after they come off the plant.
Right. Good to know.
So you can still put them in a blueberry pie where you're probably putting something sweet.
I'm less discriminate. A little sweet, a little tart is okay.
Yeah. Nice balance is good.
After a couple of 100,000 berries, you got this down, though. Blindfolded.
Kind of after many, many years of picking blueberries.
Let's go to the emails. James wants to know, if you transplant flowers or shrubs from a yard that is known to have ticks, will you be transplanting the ticks as well as the flowers into the new garden?
If there's a tick on that plant, you'll be moving a tick. But ticks get around regardless of whether you're moving plants around or not. So I wouldn't worry about that.
Yeah, I wouldn't worry either. The ticks are going to show up where they're going to show up. And nothing we've seen really can stop them effectively. Too well.
Yeah, between deer and mice, there's going to be ticks.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Between the rodents move them.
Do you guys want to do a blueberry taste test?
They're all sitting here staring at us. Yeah.
So. Yes, indeed. I'll start with the Duke.
I'm going to try the Toro.
Yeah, the Toros are just barely starting to ripen, so I was only able to grab a few.
Mm. Lovely. That is a nice blueberry.
Why are they called Blu-ray? Like, where do the names come from?
Whatever the breeder comes up with. So Northland, those are all developed in Minnesota by a breeder in Minnesota. So all the varieties that they bred are what we call half highs. So in general, they aren't supposed to get more than about 3 or 4 feet tall. Ours are 5 and 6 feet tall because they're really happy. But there's Northland, there's North Sky, there's a whole series of them that were developed in Minnesota and are very, very hardy because of it. So that's one of the benefits of getting the North series. They do tend to all be slightly smaller fruit than like the Blu-rays tend to get quite large. I have photos where they're pretty much always bigger than my thumbnail. Aurora and Liberty will get the size of quarters at times. They're later varieties. So, it's nice for people to come out and pick a number of different varieties. They can keep them separate or they can mix them all together and have a fantastic tasting blueberry pie.
Well, I've only tried two, but they're both really delicious.
So you tried the Toro and what else?
And Blu-ray.
Blu-ray.
Blu-ray. You were right. Blu-ray is really good.
Nice, Blu-ray.
I'm with you. And Duke was pretty good.
Yeah. So we'll have Greg try the Duke And the Spartan as well.
They don't know that I was sitting really far away from the blueberries.
Yeah, he was.
He was.
I'm in prime position.
Yeah, you were in prime position. Yep. I got to say, the Blu-ray gets my vote. And I remember this last year, too. And that was also, I think, my top choice then as well. That Blu-ray is hard to beat.
And for a homeowner, Blu-ray is a really nice one. It's really hardy. It's nice and big. It's very
So easier
reliable.
To grow?
It is. It's not as fussy. So
not
yes,
as fussy.
It's easier
wow.
to grow.
So
when you get them at the store, what variety is that typically? Or is that just a mix of whatever?
That's a mix. And a lot of those right now are coming out of New Jersey and Michigan. And they tend some of these varieties would be grown there. But they also have their own set of varieties. Probably a lot of Dukes are coming out of those states. Blu-ray is still grown pretty widely in New Jersey. But a lot of the commercial, big commercial guys are going to some of the newer varieties, which have not yet ripened for us.
Oh.
Yeah.
And then if the ones you get in the early spring or winter could be Georgia or Northern Florida. And that's a whole different series of blueberries that are not hardy for us at all.
Right. We wouldn't get those. And they're California ones, too.
Yeah.
Yeah. They're called rabbit eye blueberries. I think they're even a different species.
I think they are. I think they're southern species and probably have some corymbosum mixed in there. Just they probably have crossed them. There's probably at least half a dozen, if not more, blueberry species in North America. You know, there are lots of different, you know, hardy tiny ones and kind of mid-sized ones and southern ones. So there's I don't even know all of them, but there's plenty. And then some come from Peru. Peru's a big blueberry grower. I'm not sure which selections those are, but more likely the warmer selections.
Right. So ones that are coming from California are probably more Peruvian in nature.
Yep.
You probably will not find a Blu-ray coming out of California. Different, and they have a different flavor profile. They also have, I think, different texture.
Yeah. We're talking gardening here on Vox Pop with Fred Breglia, Greg Ward, and Dale Isla Riggs. The number to call is 1-800-348-2551 or shoot us an email at voxpop@wamc.org. We're going to take a quick break. Welcome back to Vox Pop. We're talking gardening. The number to call is 1-800-348-2551. I've got some calls sitting, so let's go to Joanne in Queensbury. Hi, Joanne.
Yes, hi. I have some summer raspberries, and the ones that have been there for a few years are not doing as well as the ones that are creeping into new soil. And can I use a fertilizer so that I can keep the ones that aren't doing so well growing, or what should I do with them?
So first I would try to figure out why those original plants maybe are not doing quite so well. Raspberries do have a habit of creeping outward, so that's not too unusual. It may be that you have some raspberry cane borer in there. So if you're seeing any of the plants with a wilting at the top, that indicates that there's an insect in the middle of the cane that is a problem. Also, raspberries do not like wet feet. And we've had a couple with having some really wet springs. It may be that you've got some root rot issues going on in there. And always certainly checking soil pH is a good idea, although if the outer ones are doing okay, that's probably not too much of an issue.
And what about just the fact that they are the older ones and it may be really congested in there?
Yeah, that could be that they do grow outward for a reason, and you want to keep them pruned along the outside so that you're trying to keep them in a set place.
So that those new shoots don't come up in the lawn, they come up in the bed.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Just like the ones coming up outside our raspberry tunnel instead of inside our raspberry tunnel.
Yeah. And so if that's the case, would this be a good year, or maybe it's not an ideal time, to do some renovation?
I would wait until the spring to do renovation. I think what might be good is if you take a couple photos and get them to your local Cooperative Extension Master Gardeners. And they could help you figure out if it's just a matter of them getting too congested and trying to move outward, or if you have some type of insect or disease issue going on.
Well, I have another. I have the heritage raspberries also that have been there for a lot longer than these summer raspberries, and they have never, they've never had a problem. But so I cut those down to maybe 6 inches from the soil, and you know, and then they come up the next year. But these other ones, I think they're called Boyne, B-O-Y-N-E. Mm-hmm. They, you know, they're, the berries are beautiful, but they're very, seems like they're very temperamental.
Yeah, the Boynes are a summer variety of raspberry, whereas the Heritage are a fall variety of raspberry. So the Boynes, the Boynes grow, produce their fruit on this, what we call second year canes, or the branches that come off the grain, the canes that grew last year. So Boyne, the cane will grow 1 year, and then the second year they put out side branches, and that's what your fruit is on. The Heritage will grow and produce fruit the very first year. They'll produce it this fall, and then they could produce raspberries next year if you leave the canes there. But you don't need to. You can always just cut them down to the ground. The Boynes, if, do you normally prune them out pretty heavily each year after fruiting?
Yes, I take all of the canes that had fruit on them out.
Perfect.
I remove them, but you know, there's a lot of bare. Is this a is this what a borer looks like? There's a lot of bare stalks coming up out of them.
What do you mean bare stalks coming up? They grew this year, but they don't have leaves on them.
Right. Yeah.
That sounds like you might have some raspberry crown borer in there, which will go after the base of the plants. And yeah, so I would get some samples into your master gardeners.
It's just the top of them that do that. It doesn't go down to the bottom. I don't know what's going on.
Okay, so then that could be a cane borer, which is an insect that lays its egg inside the cane partway up. So then the top of the cane dies and the bottom of the cane is still alive.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
So what do you do? As soon as you see the cane, you cut it off below the where it's turning brown?
Yeah, usually you'll see two rings around the cane, and that the insect actually has walled off where its egg is. It will be between those two circles around the cane, and just cut it off below that, and that way you're eliminating the insect and it will allow the side branches to grow.
Perfect. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thanks, Shuin. Let's go to Lynn in Shelburne. Hi, Lynn.
Hi there. Thank you for taking my call. My phlox, my tall phlox, are, I think, having a problem with powdery mildew, and I'm wondering what's the best thing for that.
Yeah, it's a big one this year. I'm starting to see that around a lot as well.
So it's getting a little late to do this, but you know, if you start to see it in mid-late June, you actually cut the plant back, removing a lot of the mildew and stems, and then as the new growth comes up, you could consider treating it with a fungicide. And there's very lots of choices, but just simply missing that humid weather, the new growth will come up and they'll bloom a couple of weeks later. You know, if you ever go to New Hampshire or Maine, you see those tall phlox blooming in mid-August, not in mid-July. And so I don't know that there's really enough time now. You could consider that, though, because once you have all that mildew on the plant, you can't really remove it. You can't get it off those leaves.
Yeah.
It's all about, you know, keeping the leaves that don't have it clean. So by cutting it down, you'll get some new growth, and you may get some bloom still late in August.
Yeah, you don't have a real lot to lose, because if it's in, you know, really covered with powdery mildew now, there's no real good treatment for the existing powdery mildew. It's and you know they might still bloom. You know, I've seen them definitely bloom with that, but it's not going to be a great. You know, it's not great. So, and cutting them is not going to hurt the plant. It's just, you know, whether or not you're going to have enough time to get some real flowers in there or not.
They'll look better reflushing, even if they don't have time to
bloom.
That's
kind of what I'm thinking, too.
Yeah. And then
how far can I cut them back?
I would probably take them down, you know, fairly far. I mean, wherever you have to. I would leave maybe like 8 or 10 inches of stem, something like that.
Okay. Leafless.
Of a stem, and then there'll be a few kind of discolored leaves or white leaves, and you could kind of pinch all those off so that it'll all be new bud growth off of those stems and then also out of the ground.
You will need to protect the new growth that's coming up, though, because that can still get powdery mildew. You can actually use baking soda. I'm sure there must be recipes online for how much baking soda to use, but that is a treatment for powdery mildew.
Any of the other treatments over the counter that are...
So baking soda you can actually get over the counter. There are some products out there that are baking soda based. The other things for powdery mildew are sulfur. I believe anything with copper in it will also work. And then several other products that would be specific to powdery mildew if you go to your local garden center. Chamomile tea is another one. Both the baking soda and the chamomile tea is something you want to apply, a couple times a week, 2 or 3 times a week, just to control that. The other, of course, thing we didn't mention is, you know, good air circulation is really helpful to minimize powdery mildew. This spring was kind of tricky for that because it was so wet and humid all the time and still is apparently. But, you know, getting them in an open area, making sure the plants that are growing around them are far enough away that you get good air circulation around that clump.
What can I say? Just one more thing. When I cut these down to about 8 inches, there are no leaves down there. I have plucked all the nasty ones off.
Right. Exactly.
It's going to put out new growth from that root system, because the root system at this point in the game has enough stored energy to be able to refoliate.
And it'll take, 7 or 10 days before you start to see anything. And it'll probably it'll be 2 or 3 weeks before it's kind of soft and green at the top and short, but looking pleasant.
Right. That's fascinating. Thank you so much for your help.
Yep. Thanks, Lynn. Jim in Lanesboro says, the leaves on my common lilac bushes are turning brown and falling off. Is this condition fatal? Will they be okay next year?
Yep, so not fatal. That's the good news. And it's common this year. It's this setup with the really wet spring and the humidity was just a perfect breeding ground. We kind of thought that was going to be the case. It has been the case, and it's just, you know, widespread. I'm seeing it at the Arboretum. I'm seeing it on my own lilac shrubs at my house. It's really common. But the good news is, it looks really, really bad, but they're going to come all back next year and look just fine. And will they get it again? It depends on the growing condition. So if it's similar to what we had this year, really, really wet, really, really humid, it could happen multiple years in a row. Last year was another year where we actually saw quite a bit of this. And this year, all the lilacs that I saw it on came back perfect, but now I'm starting to see leaves drop. They're looking, and depending on the variety, they could look really, really bad, almost, you know, you're seeing a lot of bare stems, or they could just be like some weird looking leaves. They don't look great. And I've seen a mix of all of the above, but they are going to, it's not fatal, and they will come back.
Yeah. And they don't, that's, you know, that common traditional, you know, Mother's Day blooming lilac does not put out new leaves at this point. It's done. So you won't see any new ones, or very few, if it does it at all.
That's right.
But that's okay.
It'll look pretty bad for the rest of the season. But it, like I said, it gets another shot at life next year.
All right. Rachel says they have too many violets in their lawn. How do they solve that?
I like violets in my
Me
lawn.
Too. Mowing.
I mean, don't like them in the garden as much. They're tough to weed out. I mean, not terrible.
Yeah. But I would just say mowing would probably control most of them.
Yeah. I mean, you know, they're a broadleaf plant. There are, you know, products that you apply to your lawn to control broadleaf plants. You know, I think violets are a pretty fun thing to have in the lawn, and they're green all summer. So
they
I
are.
Personally wouldn't do it, but they do. That's what those lawn weed controls are looking for, broadleaf weeds.
Yeah, but a lot of times, you know, when, especially at the Arboretum, we always look for it. Is it green? Does it look green? And if it does, we don't really care if it's a mix of all kinds of plants. And you know, violets are certainly not one that we would be upset to see. We like to see them as well.
Jennifer says they have a vole in their garden. I Googled it. It's different than a mole, apparently.
It is.
he's eating the beans and squash and cucumber plants. Is there anything I can do to prevent him from eating them, or do I have to get rid of him from the garden?
You need to get rid of him
yes,
from the garden.
Yes, get rid of him.
You're going to need to use like a mousetrap.
You have more than one also.
Yeah, yes. If you see one, you've got more than one. And a mousetrap, unfortunately, is probably the only way to really proceed. We always say cover the mousetrap over. Delilah's got a really great trick that she uses some PVC pipes. I believe if I remember that right, you like a 4-inch PVC diameter.
A 4-inch because that gives,
it'll give you the snap.
Right, gives you space for the trap to snap. Yep. The other thing is to use a little have a heart trap, and then decide where it's going to get relocated to.
Which
in
of
my
course,
house, obviously.
Which of course is not legal, at least in Massachusetts, probably not in New York State.
No, it's not New York.
You're supposed to move animals.
Only within your own site.
Yes.
So if it's your property, you can move it around the property. But otherwise, you're not supposed to move them beyond that.
Yeah, we move our woodchucks to our back hedgerow and
nice
point them in the opposite direction.
And hope they continue that line up.
Right.
Nancy says, I have jumping worms in my vegetable garden. How do I get rid of them? Will they do harm to the garden soil?
So, you know, jumping worms are a pain. I think they're here to stay. You know, in a garden, they're not too hard to control. They are very shallow boring. They don't tunnel down deep. They're kind of shallow first inch or two of the soil. They're real easy to see. Cornell website has a really good identification some photos with some great ID features on there, and they're pretty easy to distinct between those and regular earthworms, which do a lot of good. The problem with the jumping worm is that they break down organic matter faster than it builds up, and in the forest, they're really, really not good. But I think hand picking them is the best way. You see them, you just pull them out, and what we do is at home, if you see them, you just get like a 5-gallon pail. And just throw them in the 5-gallon pail, and they'll dry out very quickly. And then after that, you know, you can dispose of them.
That's what I find. If you're in the garden and, you know, your vegetable garden, and you're going through it, yep, you know, regularly, weekly, say, or maybe more often, and you're weeding a little bit and you come across them, then just collect them as you go.
As you see them.
And that does help keep the numbers down, doesn't certainly get rid of them. And then there are, we don't offer anything like this, but you may be able to find it. There are some mustard-based products that are somewhat effective at bringing them to the surface. And and so those are – I know some golf courses that may use that kind of thing. But that there isn't really any easy way to kind of rid them from your garden.
Are they good for fish bait?
I would not use them only because now you might actually get them out into another area. So
that's true.
a big no-no, but certainly the action on a hook would be desirable. But no, otherwise I would highly not recommend that. Just because, like I said, you know, you can get them out into the environment, and that's the worst place we can get them is in the woods. And so no, not for you.
Okay. I'll stick to my night crawlers.
You got to stick to your night crawlers.
All right. And lastly here, we're going to go to the email. Colleen says, my red currant plants are about 18 years old. They have white pine blister rust. Production has varied over the years, and this year was very light. I cut them back last year. Are the plants aging out? Is it rust? What are your thoughts?
Well, she's thought it was rust, and now she's asking if it is rust.
Yeah.
Yeah. So they can definitely get old and woody and not be able to perform as well. And so you know, sort of renovating them, not unlike a blueberry, is going to be helpful. That would be the first thing. She sent you a photo.
Oh, no. I'm Googling it.
Okay. So as you can see, that you know, it's going to be rusty looking. And so if she's seeing that on the foliage, you know, and or the stems there, then she has some rust issues, which could be stifling the plant.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And if you have white pine nearby, it's a good chance.
Yes. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, especially with an 18-year-old variety. There's some newer varieties that have some resistance, but at that age, I would say try renovating the plant and pruning back a lot next spring and seeing if it does better.
All right. We are just about out of time, but I want to thank everyone who called in and apologize to those I left on the line and in the inbox. I'd also like to thank our guests, Fred Breglia, Greg Ward, and Dale Isla Riggs, for joining us today.